My name's Cindy Masters. I'm an alcoholic. Because of the grace of God, some simple actions in this program, and both sides of sponsorship, I've been sober since December 17th, 1985, and for that I'm very grateful. That's the biggest deal in my life today. Because that's the biggest deal in my life today, I have a life today. And I continue to make it the biggest deal in my life today because I want to keep a life today. I'm not somebody that Alcoholics Anonymous renewed my life. Alcoholics Anonymous breathed life into me. This is my only hope. I guess I'll get some housekeeping out of the way. Thank you for inviting me here. Mark, for your tenacity and communicating with me, which is not always easy, and especially when I'm in and out of the hospital. And thank you to my honorary hosts, Robert and Misha and Meredith, who have really stepped in, and to Kyle, my newcomer. I was part of Fresh this weekend. So thank you very much. I hope, I've been sober a long time. I've been sober longer than I drank. And so I hope that what I'll share with you is mostly about recovery, because that's where the rubber meets the road. I believe that probably everybody except for the Al-Anons in this room knows how to drink unsuccessfully. But how do we live through all the things that life brings us sober? But I'll tell you enough about me to qualify. I've been drinking since I was this big. I drank for exactly what it talks about in the textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous. I drank because of the effect produced by alcohol. Now, what that looked like for me wasn't didn't make me feel taller, didn't make me feel more good looking, didn't do any of that for me. I grew up feeling like I was bleeding from the inside out. I hurt all the time, and I didn't have anything to do with it. When I drank, I didn't hurt as much, and that's why I drank. The problem is that by the time I reached the end of my drinking, the thing that kind of helped me keep from hurting had become the thing that was the catalyst for most of my pain, and I didn't know it because I still perceived it as my friend that took that away, and I got caught in that crazy cycle that happens with alcoholism. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous the first time in October of 1980. So it took me 5 years to really finally get here, get sober. The first time I got here, I was only 17 years old, barely 17. And what that looked like at 17, I didn't have a hope, a dream. I didn't have anything left. I had hitchhiked all over this country. I'd been on my own. I went to a bunch of high schools because I was in over 25 institutions. And so usually, and I'm not talking about just like little baby institutions. I was in State Mental Hospital in the 70s, did fairly long tours there. I was in jails. I burnt the system out. They didn't know what to do with me, and I was so angry. You know, I was so angry. I've only seen a couple of people come in as angry as I was. I was untouchable. I was unapproachable, and I hated. I just hated, and I was going to hate you before you hated me, because I knew you were going to hate me. And so I was a survivor, and I was a street person. When I got here, my last drunk before Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm a blackout drinker. There's nothing pretty about my drinking. It's rather disgusting. I only had one thing I still cared about. I'd been in this foster home, and my foster brother and sister had muscular dystrophy. And they were the only people that I ever believed life was less fair to than to me. Because, see, I felt like such a victim. I felt like life had just been really not fair at all, and I was really mad about it. And when I lived with them, they had never even walked. Two things happened in that foster home that were really great that I relearned when I got to AA. I helped put those kids to bed, and I helped feed them. And I learned a sense of usefulness that I didn't ever tap in again to until I got here. And it probably saved my life. And I learned that there's always somebody worse than me. I am never the worst case, no matter how bad it feels. And I relearned that later in Alcoholics Anonymous. But anyway, I was living in D.C. I'm not going to go into the details of what street life was like for me. If you have experienced it, you know. And if you haven't, it's probably as bad as you imagine. So I hitchhiked back from D.C. to Cincinnati, which was home base, because my foster brother was having a surgery that nobody expected him to survive. Now, he did survive, and I did the exact same thing I would have done if he died. You see, because what I did at any emotion was I drank. I just drank. I called it celebrating because he survived. If he had died, I would have called it grieving, but it wouldn't have looked any different. Now, what I'm going to relay to you, I don't have any personal memory of. This was mostly relayed to me by, by police officers in the court system. I used to carry a gun. Because I found that, now, people that know me now, it's hard to believe, like, that I never had a voice. But I didn't have a voice. I didn't know how to talk to people. And so I found that if I brought my gun out, they paid real good attention. My girlfriend, I was drunker than hell, and my girlfriend was trying to run away from me. Imagine. She goes into a retail store to get away from me, thinking that I'm not crazy enough to go in a retail store with my gun to talk. I did. I went in with the gun to try to have a conversation. You see how I'm always a victim? All I wanted to do was talk, and I wound up... Before it was over, I woke up in University Hospital in Cincinnati, tied down to a stretcher hanging on a wall. I had been beat I was black and blue from here to right above my knees from where I'd been beat by billy clubs. If I hadn't been a cute, young white girl, I'm quite sure I would have been shot instead. That's just the truth of it when I get down in. But I woke up a victim. And I'm like, who did this to me? Because, see, people are always doing bad things to me, you know? And it's like, who did this to me? Sorry about that. And, you know, who I'm animated, I'm Italian, but, you know, it's like, you know, who did this to me? And a nurse said, you did. And she said, you're an alcoholic. Well, I didn't like that. I was from the streets. I'm a garbage can. I do it all. But the last thing I wanted to be was an alcoholic. That's kind of disgusting and gross. You know, there's nothing. See, because I still had all this bravado, and I really thought I was cool. I thought I was bad, you know, and it's like, so being an alcoholic, there's nothing cool. There's nothing bad. There's nothing like that with that. And I'm 17 years old. Then she broke the great news to me and said, the police are coming. And she said, you're not going to juvenile. They're taking you to county. Now, I'm barely 17 in 1980. That's an unusual thing to have happen. I had 7 felonies. That's what carrying a gun into a retail store and deciding to try to discuss it with the police when they get there, and then wrestling with them, if you want to call it that, that all turns out to be 7 felonies. I had the really good fortune of going into extreme withdrawal in jail. And I was malnourished. It's always hard for people to believe that now, but I was... I was malnourished, and I'd been beaten by the streets. I'd just been beaten. And my drinking had reached a place that I just wanted my life to be over. I tried to kill myself multiple times, and I came really close. I mean, I've had tubes in my nose. I've been in ICUs. I've had all that, but I just never could die. I didn't have anything I wanted to live for. There was just nothing, you know? Game over. No education, nothing I was going to grow up and be, nothing I was going to do. And so they took me, they got me into treatment. I don't know how it happened. I went into withdrawal, went back to the hospital. Somehow I got to go to treatment. And I hated it. I went to treatment in a place called Georgetown, Ohio. It's mostly cornfields. And I was with a bunch of old men. And you could not have put together a complete set of teeth between all of them. I mean, you know, it's like... And remember, I'm mad, all right? And I'm going to prove to you I'm mad. I'm going to prove to you I'm tough. And my mouth had nothing but profanity that came out of it. And these farmers, they don't think they'd heard much about, like, the kind of words I used. And I used my vocabulary as a weapon. You see, I didn't want you to get close, but all I wanted was for you to get close. I didn't want you to get near, but all I wanted was, why won't you care about me? But I'm going to push you away before you reject me. because I'm so sure that I'm unlovable and I'm rejectable. You know what those old farmers and their wives did? They loved me from a distance. They threw candy. I was kind of like a circus act. Throw some candy at her, you know? What they were that, and the people from AA that came, what they were that I had not experienced in a long time is that they were kind. I didn't want them to know that I liked it. I didn't want them to know I liked it. So I cussed at them. But I liked it. After a few weeks, you know, I started having talks with some of them. And they said, Cindy, why don't you work these 12 steps? Your life can be different. And I said to them with all sincerity, I wish that were true for me, but you don't understand. You see, I'm broken. You see, all those institutions I was in, everyone gave me a title. They're the only titles I got, you know, besides alcoholic. You know, they gave me titles, names, labels. I bought into it. I bought into it. There's something profoundly wrong with me. I am a social reject. I even have sexual feelings I shouldn't have, and believe me, in the Midwest in the 70s and early 80s, that wasn't good. You know, I thought there was something profoundly wrong with me. If I tried the steps and they didn't work, it proved that everything everybody said was right. And as long as I didn't try them, I had nothing to lose. So I got out of there and I went to the local AA clubhouse in Cincinnati, which was about, I don't know, an hour's drive away. And I hung out in AA because it was the, you guys let me sleep on your couches, man. You bought me dinner. You bought me breakfast. It was good. You know, it was the best I'd had in a long, and you didn't even make me do much. You know what I mean? It's like, so I was not going to give this up too quick. Unfortunately, hanging out in Alcoholics Anonymous is not enough to keep somebody like me from drinking. And what I'll do is I'll take you with me. So I took a couple of guys from AA to Clubhouse and took them out drinking. And when I drink, I break out in felonies usually. And and I'm very lucky because I'm the kind of drunk that always gets caught. I people that don't get caught, it takes them a lot longer to get help. Well, because I always get caught, because see, when I drink, I'm just an idiot. I mean, I really am. I'd like to paint it pretty and sexy or even say that I'm delusional about how I was, but I'm an idiot. And so I got a great idea to borrow some carpet from a model home in broad daylight. See, I wasn't joking. I'm an idiot. And I got caught, and I got lucky because... I got charged as a juvenile, and I got to go to a halfway house in Lexington, Kentucky. There were no halfway houses for women in Ohio or Indiana at that time. There was one halfway house in Lexington, Kentucky. And I went there, and it probably changed my life. It gave me a foundation. The biggest thing I learned there, just to kind of summarize what I got out of that experience, is that all my life I thought in those institutions, if they would have given me the right shrink, or if they would have given me the right counselor, the right person that could help me feel better about myself and like myself. You remember that old Saturday Night character, you know, Saturday Night Live character, if I like myself, I love myself. You know, well, that just doesn't work for me, you know. But I thought if somebody else had that magic juice that would make me feel like that, I would get to act like other people. I would get to have a life like other people have. And so what I learned there was that I had it in reverse. That what gets me to like myself and feel better about myself is acting differently. And it only happened because I was forced to. For instance, I didn't think I belonged in AA. They made me show up early and make coffee, stay late, and clean up. And you know what happened? Everybody started to know my name. And all of a sudden, I began to feel like I fit. They made me get a J-O-B. Now, I'm still only 17 years old. I'm 6 months into trying at this deal. And what kind of job can you get with no high school education, 17 years old, nothing, Well, I got a job setting tobacco, and that's hard work. But let me tell you what that terrible job did for me. My shoulders went back. I bought my own coffee and cake after the meeting, and I stopped manipulating you to do it. I started to feel better about myself because I acted like people that feel better about themselves act, instead of trying to wait until you would make me feel good enough that I could act right. And I learned that the changing my actions changed my feelings. My feelings never, it never works the other way around. I always wanted to do it either cerebrally or emotionally, and it doesn't. It's my feet that change my life. Then they said they want me to go get my GED. GED. Well, here was my response to GED. That's for losers. I don't want a GED. That don't count. That's for people that weren't smart enough to do high school. What I really was afraid that I was street smart and book dumb. So they had me go take these little classes, and I took this test to see where I should be in the classes. They said, you don't have to take any classes. And I took my GED, and I scored in the top 2 percentile of people that take it. But the point with that is that thing that I was like, that sucks. Who wants that? GED. All of a sudden, I'm like throwing my shoulders back. Look at me. I'm Sandra G. I got a freaking GED. You know? Because, see, that's what I do. If I am going to reject it and hate it because I'm not good enough for it. I'm going to reject you. I'm going to not like you before you don't like me. You know, it's like I approached my whole life like that, from this really negative, ugly, blah. Whoa. So I went back to Ohio, and I was an AA Wonder Girl. Because when you come really bad in, you know, like you guys know, when you come in and like you're really, like nobody really thinks you stand shot, and then all of a sudden you start talking in complete sentences, like you are popular, you know, and they had me talking everywhere, and I'm in the middle of the gig, and then I don't know about you guys, but I'll just have a committee, you know, I got a firing squad. And it sounds like this. Oh, you think those people like you? They don't really like you. They don't know you. They don't know the truth. Or you stole from handicapped kids. Or you're just awful. Well, look at all the things you did. You suck. Now, I don't know about you, but I drank to shut that up. You know, only at the end of my drinking, it didn't shut up even totally wasted. It still went on. That chatter of what a miserable excuse for a human being I was. And that's the great kind of inside love I got, right? So what am I going to do? Drink and try to shut it up? Put a gun in my mouth? Or I can do this thing they've been trying to get me to do called make amends. And I did. And I had to go to the Muscular Dystrophy Association. I'd done a fundraiser when I lived in that foster home. And I tried to invest that money. Yeah, you get it. That was not successful. But see, here's the thing. People say that we're insensitive people. I hear people say that. And I hear people say that by nature we're liars, cheats, and thieves. And I want to say I disagree with all of that. I am a hypersensitive person. And when I do something wrong, it eats my lunch and I hate myself. And I drink to try to make it go away. And unfortunately, when I drink, I do other stuff that makes me hate myself more. And then I have to drink, and I get in that terrible cycle. And as far as liar, cheater, thief, I learned those skills. I'm really good at that. I learned it because I had to survive, but it's not my nature. It's not who I am. I was born perfect. I believe that. I believe that God loves me so much, and I don't believe that God would make somebody that's born a liar, cheat, and thief. And I believe that when I get to be my authentic self, that I'm not. I'm kind, I'm compassionate, I'm honest. That's who God made. So I became a liar, cheat, and a thief because I was a survivalist because of my disease. I didn't ever want to be that person again, but it's not who I am, and I refuse to accept it as my identity. When I do something wrong, if I don't clean it up, 20 years later, it'll still be harping at me. That's why this beautiful program works so well. because it has a way out for all of those terrible, crazy thinking stuff that goes on inside of most of us. I've sponsored a lot of people, so I'm pretty clear that I'm not the only one. I've got to really kind of hurry this up because I really got a lot of things to talk about in my recovery with y'all. But I will say this: I took a job with the Muscular Dystrophy Association for making amends. They gave me a job of the Outlying Counties Executive Director. It was a fluke thing. I was 20 years old. I was a couple years sober. I had no business in that job, but my ego took the job. Okay, my ego took the job because I've got to be more to be enough. You see, I have a kind of ego that I can be on a Greyhound bus and think I'm going to get discovered by somebody in Hollywood. And I'm not even kidding, you know what I mean? It's like I have that kind of ego. And so, see, I never thought I was really better than anybody, but I felt like I had to have a little better car, a little better job, a little better place to live so that you're good, so that I'm good enough for you to be in my house, to be in my car, to be around. Because just being me has never been enough, ever. So I took that job and I didn't have a clue. What do you do with a secretary? I bought a pink fuchsia suit. I had almost a purple neon. Well, I learned from the drag queens, right? So unfortunately, the regional supervisor had to talk to me about my dress code. I so knew I didn't belong in that job. But I would come to AA and I would tell you how great I was. I would tell you, you work the steps, you too can have a new car, a new house, and a new job. I missed it. See, I thought when people came up here and talked, what I heard them say is that if you do this deal right, you will get a house, you will get your family back, and all things will be rosy. And that's not what AA says at all. And that doesn't have anything to do with quality sobriety, what kind of car I drive, where I live, not what kind of job I have. What has to do with quality sobriety for me is if I place myself in a position to be of maximum service to God, period. Am I willing to align my will with God's will like I made a decision to do in the third step? And am I willing to trust that and put my life on a service plane? I've seen people do it in the projects, and I've seen them have some of the most meaningful lives of anybody. So I don't know why I felt a need to clear that up, but because my ego grabbed onto that, and I wanted you guys to like me. I wanted you to approve of me. I wanted to be an AA success story. And so I came to meetings and I lied. I lived a double life sober. You see, the one thing that it says that we have to do if we want to be and stay sober is we must have a capacity to be honest. For me, what that means today is it means that I'm one person. It means that my work self, my AA self, and my home self are the same person. I don't live a compartmentalized life. I don't live a fragmented life. I am who I am. I'm authentic, and I am transparent. I couldn't do that then. I lived a lie because who I was never good enough. So I became what I thought you wanted me to be, or what you wanted me to be, or what I thought would make me okay for you. And I know this is going to surprise you, but I drank it a little less than a year on that job while going to meetings. Meeting makers don't always make it. Because if I go to meetings and I lie, if I go to meetings and I don't take the steps, fellowship's only going to carry me so far. I hate myself if I don't put these tools to work. I'm so lost in this world without these tools. Nothing works for me. When I drank, I was so relieved. I didn't have to go to that job. I had a good reason not to have to go to that job. I mean, I came back to AA the next day. I saw so many of you come in and out and in and out. And I said, I'm back. I'm ready to be sober. And I wanted to be sober, and I thought that's how it was going to be for me. But guess what? I left that meeting, and guess what I had to do? I had to drink. Because, see, I had triggered my allergy. What it talks about in the doctor's opinion, the phenomenon of craving had kicked in. And once that kicks in, I don't get to make a decision if I'm going to drink or not. It's on. And I came back and tried AA and tried AA, and to no avail, off and on for an entire year. Nothing horrible happened. No felonies, no jails. A lot of my anger had been worked through, and I wasn't always raging anymore. And my drinking was disgusting. I was a garden variety drunk. I puked on myself. I peed on myself. I would come live with you when I ran out of money, and you come live with me when you ran out of money. And that became my normal life once again. My last drunk was December 16th. It was the last time I drank, of 1985. I sat in front of my house. I come out of a blackout. And if you're a female blackout drinker, and I guess probably, I'm talking to a lot of gay men too, it's probably the same for you guys. You can wake up in a very compromised position and not know if you volunteered or not. You know? So being a blackout drinker is terrifying. So coming out of this blackout, I didn't know where I was. I'm right in front of my house, but I'm crying. Now, I'm a tough broad from Jump Street, but I'm sitting there crying because I can't find my home. That was pitiful and comprehensible demoralization. It's the worst it's ever been for me, because I knew at that moment it was never going to get any better. And the next day, I came back to AA, and I came back different. I came back with a level of humility that I had never known before. And for me, what humility means is I'm willing to do it your way, even when I think I know more. Now, one of the things I did in early recovery, I was afraid I was stupid. I wasn't stupid at all. I read the big book and memorized it. And I went to meetings and used it as a weapon. And when old timers would misquote the book, I'd be, boom, Mr. Oldtimer. Paragraph 32 does not say that. You know they loved me. So I had a sponsor who didn't know anything about the Washingtonian movement, didn't even know all the literature of the Oxford group, let alone all the stuff that everybody was doing when the IA was first formulated, and certainly hadn't memorized the big book. And I was willing to listen to her, even though she didn't have the head knowledge I had. See, I couldn't see the forest for the trees. I knew it all, but I didn't understand any of it. And the first thing she did, and this is the evidence of my level of willingness, the first thing she did said, Cindy, you're not allowed to quote the big book anymore. To my astonishment, I said, okay. And I didn't have anything to say. Then she said, we're going to look at the first step. And so powerlessness and unmanageability have always been easy. I've never been in question about my powerlessness or the unmanageability of my life. She made me dig deeper. She said, I want you to look at the probable consequences if you drink again. And I rattled off what most of us probably would rattle off, right? What's the probable consequences of a drink? Jail, mental hospital, or death, right? She laughed at me. She said, you're not afraid of any of that. And see, she's right. In jail, I'm practically the vice president. I grew up there, man. I mean, I know how to work it. I know how to be okay there. I don't know how to be okay out here and pay my light bill. That's hard, all right? But being in jail, I am a huge success. In the mental hospital, oh my God, I'm the queen. I mean, unless one of you are there, but see, the bar is so low in those places. The person with the most pudding wins. I mean, it's just not hard. So she made me dig deep. And the truth is, those kind of consequences don't get any of us sober. If they did, nobody would be sitting in prison the second or third or fourth or fifth time. What I did was I looked inside and thought, what's the very, very, very worst thing that happens if I drink again? The worst thing for me is I live. For 20 years in that miserable existence of my alcoholism. Because see, when I'm drinking, I become a big black hole. And I'm going to suck the life out of anybody that gets near me. Now, I don't think so. I think I'm generous. I think I'm kind. But I'm not. I'm not. I I want to love you, but I lose my ability to love you. See, I can't love when I drink because I love the drink. See, and it's always going to come slightly ahead of you, even though I'm going to tell you it's not, and even though I don't want it to be true. It is a truth for me. I don't want to live 20 years and my big legacy sitting on my tombstone or whatever says, Cynthia Masters, a big black hole sucked the life out of everybody that got near her. I don't want it to be the thing that I'm remembered by. I don't want it to be the legacy I leave. See, you guys taught me enough about what it feels like. See, the juice to this thing is when I get to give you something, anything. That's the juice. When I watch the lights come on, the first time I worked the steps with somebody, oh my God, it's so beautiful. It's so beautiful. It's the number one best, happiest, most great experience I've ever had in my life. But that is still my motivation today. See, I know I'm not beyond a drink. I'm 28 years sober every day in a row. But I'm not beyond a drink. I've watched enough of my friends drink, you know, and I'm not beyond it. And I don't ever want to be so arrogant to think that I have anything other than sobriety that's contingent upon the maintenance of my spiritual condition each day. Not on my spiritual condition, but on the maintenance of it. Because I can control my spiritual condition, but I sure can't control what I do to maintain it. My rituals in the 11th step and doing that sort of thing. I've embraced everything AA gave me because I didn't have a life before AA. I didn't have hope of a life before AA. I have had jobs and lost jobs. I've had relationships and lost relationships. I've had people be born and I've had people die. And guess what I haven't done for 28 years? I haven't picked up a drink. I've been bored to pieces. That's the hardest one, you know? And I haven't drank. I'm going to share with you some stories of my recovery that have been sort of where the rubber has met the road. It started the first time I moved from Cincinnati, where I was an AA legend in my own mind. And I would walk into any meeting, and people would know me. Cindy, Big Book Cindy is what they call me. You know, and I walk into the meeting, and I would feel loved. And I moved to Louisville, and nobody knew me, and nobody cared. And I felt very sorry for myself. And I woke up with tears in my eyes every day. I also quit smoking, so that might have had something to do with it. And I was 9 years sober. And this went on for almost a year. And then the magic light turned back on, thank God, because I probably would have drank if it didn't. And the magic light turned on, and I remembered that I only feel loved, comforted, and understood when I try to love, comfort, and understand you. I never feel loved, comforted, and understood looking for it, ever. I never feel better trying to get you to like me. I only feel better trying to like and love you. And so when I started being the person that stood there and looked for the newcomer, a fellowship began to grow up around me, and I was reminded of how this deal really works. You know, it's by what I want to give is the only way I get. It's something inside of me that's the only way I operate. And whenever I'm hungry and needy and greedy and need, I always wind up empty because I'm always focused on me and where's mine and how am I going to get enough. And for me, that's my alcoholic brain. And when I'm focused on you, and how can you be comfortable? How can I love you? How can you feel safe? All of a sudden, I feel loved, I feel safe, I feel comfortable. That's the way this thing works, and it's magic. It's absolute magic. When I was in 1997, I was, I think, 11 years sober, and my grandmother died. And it was a big deal for me because there weren't a lot of consistent, loving people. There were people in my life that were loving, but they could be also brutal the next day. She was very loving all of the time. She taught me that love is the answer no matter what the question. You know, she exampled it to me. She went to church all the time. And everybody that goes to church all the time scares me to death, you know, because I know they don't like me. My grandmother grew up in an era where, you know, it's kind of popular to be prejudiced in her era. My grandmother never uttered a negative word towards a single person or group of people ever. She was kind to everybody. I want to emulate her so much. She gave me and my girlfriend her bed when we visited, the same as any other couple. She did not judge me. She loved me. And when she died, she was terrified. And I got so mad at God. I thought, God, how can you take this little woman that's been nothing of service but service to you and your kids and let her be scared when it's time to meet you? I don't want nothing to do with you. Because, see, it wasn't the God that I thought I found in these rooms. And my grandmother, I'll just say this real quick, that I got my definition of spirituality from her because a lot of people in AA say that fear and faith can't live in the same house. I completely disagree with that. I'm afraid to be here with you and vulnerable, but because I have faith, I can. So they always both live here. The key is, which one do I feed? You see, when I feed fear, I'm negative, I'm cynical, I'm bitter, I gossip, and I'm jealous. This is my spiritual barometer. And when I feed faith, I'm loving, I'm kind, I'm generous. That tells me where I am spiritually, and that is how I judge myself. I don't try not to judge you, but that is how I judge myself. So for this person that had defined that to me to be so afraid to go meet God, I was done. And what I did right was I went to AA and I told the truth. This tough bride went to meetings and I would... good morning. went to meetings and I would cry because I couldn't feel God. Because once you've had a spiritual experience, it's very lonely when you don't feel connected to God. And I get very distracted, and I apologize. You'll find out why in a minute. But so the other thing I did was I did keep looking for God. I thought about killing myself at 12 years sober. I turned 12 years sober during that time, and I really seriously thought about killing myself. Because the truth is, my life is pretty empty without some kind of spiritual connection. Life just becomes kind of stupid to me, to be honest. It just doesn't make any sense at all without some spiritual connection. One of the things I got myself in early recovery was a big old Harley Davidson. I had a 79 FLH. FLH shovelhead for anybody that rides. And I had long fishtail pipes, and it was a hot bike. And I got that because they said that they wanted me to meditate. Now imagine this. You know what I mean? Like, I was like really kind of a hard ass, and oming was not going to fit real well with me. I couldn't even sit still. I vibrated. You know what I mean? And I had a committee that was always going. So like sitting still was like really frightening for me. But I get on that Harley and it vibrate more than me. You know what I mean? I'm getting the wind and I could feel God. Because see, God will meet me where I am. I don't have to be able to be on a mountaintop. I don't have to be able to ohm, although I actually kind of do sometimes now. But I don't have to be there to be able to reach God. All I have to do is want to reach God, and he'll meet me wherever I am, even on Harley Davidson. So February 1, 1998, I got on my Harley, and I'm still going through this. I've been going through it. July 1997 till February 1, 1998, and I'm still disconnected, and I'm still mad at God, and I still don't know why I'm doing this, and I still don't understand what life's about. It doesn't make any sense, and everything's stupid. And I got on my Harley, and I thought, it was a really warm day. It's usually not warm February in Louisville, Kentucky. And I got on Interstate 65. And I'm on Interstate 65, maybe 10 minutes. I'm up to 65, 70 miles an hour. And so is the rest of traffic, and some lady's not seeing me. She's coming over in my lane. Well, I think I'm going to drive out of this, but there's a concrete abutment straight in the other lane. So I can either hit that head on, or I can let her hit me. And she hit me. So according to the police report, I was thrown about 17 foot in the air. I came down on the hood of a car that was driving down the center lane of the highway. Now imagine that you're that person driving down the highway. Plop, here I am, you know? I rolled off of that car, and that car drove up me. I'm laying on the center lane of the highway. I'm in full leathers, And thank God. But my the undercarriage of the car had shredded my face. My lungs were collapsed. My heart got shifted to the left. I still have a tire track right here in my chest. I didn't know what was going on. I was scared. I thought I was going to get drove over. I didn't know I'd already get drove over. My eyes out of my head. I could only see out of this eye. I can see traffic coming. I begin to panic. I realize I'm not breathing, because with collapsed lungs, you're not breathing. So I'm not breathing. Blood's coming out of every orifice, and I realize I'm dying. And I got really scared, probably like my grandma did. Because if you think about it, we're scared to change home groups. Why wouldn't the big adventure, you know what I mean? The next big adventure be frightening to us? Then I let go in the most absolute way I've ever let go. And it was beautiful. Because what happened was I got wrapped, and I love to tell my story because I like to share this, because I had an experience with what I believe is God. And I got wrapped in white billowy clouds of love. It was just nothing but love. That was all I felt. I felt whiteness around me, and I felt love. And I absolutely never get to surprise anybody with the fact I lived, but I didn't live without any issues. I had a spinal cord injury. I have a traumatic brain injury, which was probably the hardest thing, that whole photographic memory thing. I could read, but by the time I would get to the bottom of a page, I no longer knew what the top said. I could not remember your name. I had seizures. I had to learn to walk again. I had to learn to do everything again. And AA is my family. You are who took care of me. When I got out of the hospital, you took me to all the clinics, all that. I lost everything I owned. I lost my business. I was on food stamps. I was on Social Security disability. It hardly took a minute to get on it because I was so severely disabled. Nobody expected me to function again. And the truth is, the things that I thought really gave me something special, I thought I was kind of cute, and I was hard to believe. I was a hard body kind of going into that accident. And my intelligence, I always had taken a fair amount of pride in that. By the way, looks and intelligence, none of us can take credit for. I don't know if anybody shared that with you, but you can't. those are just gifts. They're bonuses. And my ability to earn money, because I've always been able to start businesses. I have no education, but I'm an entrepreneur, and I've always been able to just start something and make it work. Probably started hustling on the streets, you know. And I lost all that. So what's going to matter of me? What's going to be of any value to the world? What do I have to bring? I'm done. And you know what you guys did? You brought me new people. You brought me new girls that were feeling good and sorry for themselves. Oh yes. And they'd whine to you in a car on the way over. They'd get to my house. I'd be sitting there. My face looked a lot like this. I've had about 25 surgeries on my face. So I talked like this, and I looked like this. And the girl, they'd say, tell Cindy what you told us in the car on the way over. That girl would take one look at me and say, uh-uh. So we'd egg her on. Come on. So finally come out. Well, wah, wah, Cindy. My boyfriend left, and I just don't know how I'm going to go on. I'd have a seizure. She would instantly feel better. Now understand, I have a brain injury. I don't even remember your name by this point. But here's what I knew. See, I knew when people came to my house, they were feeling kind of bad. And when they left my house, they felt better. I was feeling a little like Gandhi, man. You see, here's what went right in that situation. I recognized that God used me. I didn't say, no, God, it needs to look like this. See, my idea of a spiritually moving Cindy was not having a seizure. I'd always hoped I'd be on a mountaintop somewhere. I have an alcoholic ego. But the truth is, probably the most spiritual I've ever been in my whole life is having a seizure and being vulnerable enough to sit with another person and still care about them in the middle of my mess. And you know what that did for me? I had the courage to try it all. Nobody would hire me because I looked like this and had seizures. But I got somebody to hire me on commission only. And I had golden handcuffs with my old business. And the business I have now is a result of that experience. And wow, how amazing. How amazing. I'm in technology, which is really kind of a crazy thing to go into with a brain injury because you have to learn a lot. But the nice thing is I didn't pretend. Everybody else was pretending and fooling people, and I would just go tell them the truth. I'm not really sure how that they do this, but I know that they can. And I'm going to promise you I'm going to make sure they do it. You know, and people bought a lot of stuff for me. And so when that company got acquired, I actually got put in the position of director of sales and marketing, which was kind of a big deal. And then about a month or two later, I was diagnosed with cancer. And we thought it'd be early. So I was 34 when I had the wreck and 12 years sober. I'm 36 at this point and 14 years sober. And it wasn't early. It was in my lymph nodes. And so I got mad. I kicked the door off the back of my house. I said, God, what do you want from me? I had a childhood that should have killed anybody. I come off the streets where nobody makes it out alive. You know, I come out of institutions where most people rot. You know, I'm recovering from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body called alcoholism and drug addiction. I had a highway motorcycle accident that should have killed anybody. And now I got cancer. What do you want? And I paused when agitated. And here's what I heard back. Here's what I heard back. You had a childhood that should have killed anybody. You came off the streets where nobody makes it out alive. You came out of institutions where most people rot. You're recovering from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. You had a motorcycle accident that should have killed anybody, and now you have cancer. And in that moment, the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous happened for me. Because nothing's about what happens to me. It's about what I do with it. And what happened in that moment was that I became the luckiest woman alive. Because, see, most people die from the first thing, and I'm alive all this way. See, at 36 years old, I had the wisdom of an old woman. See, wisdom doesn't come from age, and it doesn't come from just experience. It comes from experience learned from. You see, when I didn't learn from anything. I kept doing the same stupid stuff all the time. I couldn't stop myself. But because of you guys, I learn, and I become different, and I change. You know, I'm a whole human being because of you. And so in that moment, it's like, look at me. I get to make such a difference in so many people's lives because I've been through so much crap. I'm so grateful for that. And I'd like to tell you that was kind of it, but then I... See, in 6 years, I had the wreck, and then I had cancer, and then the wreck exacerbated. When I was a kid, I got kicked through doors, and my back got broke. And so that wreck exacerbated that break, and my spine was falling off. So they had to go in and cut part of my spinal canal out and put a bunch of hardware in the bottom of me so I could keep walking. And the big deal with that thing was that it triggered this trauma stuff for me. And I was in the hospital, and it would, like, click, click, click. If you've ever been through a lot of trauma, you know what I'm talking about. It's like you just can't make it go away. It's like click, 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 every bad thing that ever happened to that place in my back. And I couldn't make it go away. My sponsor said, well, deal with it when you get out of the hospital. I was in the hospital 3 weeks with that surgery. It was a big deal. And when I got out, you know what she had me do? Forgiveness work. It was like, are you kidding me? Look what happened to me, you know? Look what happened. I'm 17 years sober at this point. The long story short with that is that the man that did that to me was my dad that raised me. I was adopted, and this was the dad that raised me that adopted me. And I had hated him, and I had spoken terrible about him. Anytime somebody would say something nice about him, I would make sure they knew how not nice he was. You see, amends are not hard where I'm mostly at blame. It's easy, because I'm just coming to you saying, please forgive me, please forgive me. Let me make it right. Amends are hard where I'm only 10% to blame. Amends are hard where I have to clean up my side of the street and it's only 10%. I went to that man and I did not make amends for anything that had to do with what he did to me, but I did make amends for the way that I spoke about him and for the way that I discredited him and for my disrespect as a daughter. That was me. That may not be anybody else's story, but let me tell you what happened. I've been waiting my whole life for him to admit he did anything to me, you know, because it was always a big lie. They just locked me up, you know. That's why I was so mad. And he said my cousin had confronted him about a camping trip. He beat me with an extension cord in front of everybody. And my cousin had confronted him all these years later. My dad never remembered anything. I really think something like kind of got broke in his brain where, you know, just something happened. And so he said, well, honey, Kevin told me recently about a cabin trip. And he said, I barely remember it. He said, but he repeated my words. What do you guys help me? I'm really sorry. I was wrong. If there's anything else I've done to harm you, please let me know. He repeated my words. Well, lock and load, baby. I've been waiting my whole life to have this conversation. Which is why I had to do the forgiveness work first. And why I probably could not have made this amends until I was 17 years sober, because I would not have been spiritually ready. But what came out of my mouth was, that was a long time ago, Daddy. I forgive you. How about we try to have a decent father-daughter relationship? And we do. I'm a really good daughter. I'm a really good daughter to him and my mom. And I'm really proud of that, because I feel like, I don't know, I like myself for it. You know, I like myself. It's the high road. I wasn't anybody that ever took the high road. And I've really taken the high road with them. I love them the way I wish they could have loved me. I love them unconditionally. I show up. My dad's crazy. They thought he had this cancer, and the doctor made him wait an hour, so he blew up at the whole office, and he got kicked out, and they wouldn't see him anymore. But because of you guys, I could get him another doctor that would see him within 10 minutes. You know, it's like, I show up, and I'm not sure what gave me the ability to do that, and it took a long time. So it took a long time. I just want to reemphasize that. And a lot of support. And I always still give myself a way to get home, you know? I always give myself a way to get home. Again, in that 6 years, I had a little balance issue because of the traumatic brain injury, and I'm up in an attic. And after the cancer, I started a business, my own business. And I'm in an attic at my Victorian house, and I fell through the attic, through the rafters, and landed on my neck in a door right below. And I was paralyzed from the chest down. And I wouldn't bother to tell these stories if it wasn't witnessed by a whole lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because it just seems too unbelievable. I referred to myself as a cockroach recently, but my friends have decided to call me the Pink Panther. So I'll take that. And the only reason I share that with you is that that was really hard. I wanted to give up. I wanted to give up. I didn't know if I would ever be able to feed myself again. I didn't know if I would ever walk again. My C5 vertebrae split in half. It's been removed. I have an artificial neck. It's on Facebook if anybody wants to see. I'm kind of proud of it. It's I'm like Legos. I did learn to walk again. And I guess I want to share something with you, too. It's like, I've had to be medicated. If you get drove over by a car, or if you break your neck and you have major, major neurosurgeries, I don't take medication to deal with my chronic debilitating pain. I actually have written articles for Today's Woman magazine on how to deal with it without it. But when I have had to take medicine, somebody else always handles it. I don't handle my own ever. I don't trust myself, you know, at all. But I think because I put things in place with the people I trust around me, I've never had a need or felt a desire to abuse that medication. Matter of fact, I hate the way it makes me feel today. Somebody that always wanted to get away from where I am, I hate not being able to be present now. What a gift is that? What a turnaround. My business became really successful. I have a very small, tiny little office here in LA. That I've never been to. I have a creative director that came out here. And I have the leading interactive agency in my region. And that was while all that was going on, because what I believe happened is that I went about the business of God's business. I never, ever stopped being involved in AA. Even when I was in the hospital for 3 months with a broken neck, you guys came to me. I have always had some way to be helpful to another human being. And as long as I can be helpful to another human being, I have a reason to breathe. If I feel like I have nothing to bring to the table, whether it's having a seizure or whatever it is, if I feel like I got nothing to bring to the table, I got no reason to breathe. But you guys gave me a reason to breathe. You gave me an opportunity to be useful no matter what. Even if it's just that I don't have to drink because my neck got broke, I had cancer, I had to have a lower back fusion and with instrumentation and a motorcycle wreck. Even if all of that, if all my help is that I just don't drink no matter what happens. Oh, and I stay reasonably happy. I stay reasonably happy because I got you. Because I got you, because I know how blessed I am. You see, the death on the streets would have been worse than any of that. Death on the streets, my death of my soul. My soul has not had to die sober. Gosh, I'm a part of life. I've sat on probably half the nonprofits. I started my own nonprofit last year, which is kind of cool. I'm like involved. I'm in Leadership Louisville. I'm involved in the city. I was on the board of directors for the Entrepreneurs Organization. I mean, somebody like me, a little street urchin, you know, and it's like I'm a part of life. I spend my life on a service plane. How lucky am I? About 3.5 years ago, the hardest thing that's ever happened to me happened. Ducks don't come from chickens. Chickens don't come from ducks. And they don't come from cows either. And my brothers and sisters, there was four of us, and none of us stayed at home past 15. None of us graduated from high school. My sister got pregnant to get out. My brothers both have this disease. They've been in and out as long as I've been sober. And I love them. They call me Mama Cindy because I thought my job was to protect them. My brother Bradley does crack cocaine, and he's gorgeous. He's like a tall Robert Redford, and he's a really nice guy, and he was successful. He was a carpenter, and he made good investments, and he married somebody that controlled the money, and he had houses on the ocean in North Carolina, in Canada, Costa Rica. He was very successful, and it probably it caused him a lot of trouble because good looks and money don't help us. Good looks and money kill us because they tell us we're okay, and that doesn't make us okay. And my brother and I, we went to Costa Rica together for a week after I broke my neck. He said, come on, let's go surfing. Yeah, and I was learning to walk again, but I could surf, baby. And we went motorcycle riding in the rainforest. And I mean, I did zip lining, and I learned that I could still fly. And he stayed sober for a whole week. And we got really real and really honest, and it was so neat and so intimate and so wonderful. And I love him so much, and I'm so great. Who gets to do that with their sibling in their 40s? Who gets that? 3 years ago, it'll be 4 years in October, my brother was murdered. And he was murdered probably in the middle of a crack deal. And when I first got sober, my cousin Patty died in childbirth. She was my favorite cousin, and everybody expected me to be so grief-stricken, and I felt nothing. I looked in her casket, and I felt nothing. I was devoid of any real human emotion. My brother died, and I have cried a lot. I'm so grateful for that. I have my whole library of feelings, all of them. And I'm even glad. I'm glad. I'm not embarrassed to be weepy in front of you. I can love. I couldn't love. I love. I like love big. I love for real. Love is the answer no matter what the question is. And it's like, my brother, I don't judge him. I don't judge anybody. I'm sorry that he never got this, but I'm glad that he tried. See, the big book in the foreword to, I think, the second edition, it talks about for those of us that come and really try. And it says 25% of us get it at once. And it says another 25% get it. And then it says that for those of us that don't, if we come and really try, our lives continue to get better anyway, as long as we really try. That's the caveat. And so I can deal with almost anything happening to me, but it was really hard to feel that loss of him. just wasn't. I have another brother that's homeless half the time, and I don't know, recently he got picked up by a woman that's 20 years his senior, who's 20-some years sober, as a newcomer in a meeting. And I think I'm glad, but I'm not sure, because I know where he is. Because I know where he is. Just to get you real current, I'm going to tell you a little love story. You know, I've had a real hard time with intimacy. Into me, you see. I'm scared to death of it. I know how to have sex. How to love you and let you love me in an intimate way is really, really scary and hard for me. And I don't trust easily. And I know none of you relate to that at all. About 6 years ago, I got hooked back up with a girl I've known since I was 14 and she was 12. She used to visit me in institutions. I used to drag her to big biker events. And she's so sweet. I mean, she's like so sweet. And the truth is, if I met her today, I would never believe she was real, because I don't have those kind of trust issues. I would not believe somebody could be as sweet and as kind as she is. So anyway, we got reconnected, and I got married 5 years ago. And and I'm all in. I'm capable of a loving relationship with another human being. And she is so good to the people I sponsor. They say they want to come to my house so they can, her name's Pam, they want to come to my house so they can get pampered. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, I've had so many health problems, I'm going to always have health problems. Last year I was in Costa Rica in the summer and I had spinal seizures on the beach. I rode a horse. I shouldn't do that. the last 2 months, when I was called, when Mark called me to speak here, I had just been in the hospital and diagnosed with a stroke, and I spent the next 6 weeks not working. Usually, I always go back to work, even if I'm on a walker. And trying to figure it out, and then it looked like I had another stroke. So I was back at the hospital, and this has been about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, and then I wound up at University of Louisville's stroke ICU because I had something that was much worse. And, you know, miracles happen all the time, especially to me. And The person that's the head of U of L's stroke unit is very knowledgeable, and I never had a stroke at all. Even though I'm in ICU, I couldn't put words together. I look like a stroke person, but I have a thing that the key word is reversible, and it's from all the neurosurgeries that my vessels in my brain smashed together, and they don't work the same way as if a stroke had a blockage there, and it shows even on the CT scan, which is why they diagnosed me with a stroke. So there's a little medicine I can take, and I'm 50 years old, and I was really kind of sad about having had a stroke, and God took it away. So like, what was it, a week and a half ago, I'm in ICU, and I'm here with you guys today. And and what you have given me is you have given me the desire to want to go on no matter what. See that ambition that it talks about in the fourth step in the third column? I didn't have any. I didn't want to go on no matter what. And today I want to go on no matter what. I can love. Love for me is the juice here. I am going to say something really hokey. And I want you to just really try to believe this. I love you. I love you. Like, I really love you. And that's probably all I need to say. Thank you for having me.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.